Yeah, but that's not one of them.
That's not one of them.
Call the House Committee on Healthcare to order. Announce first that we are holding off, we are postponing the public hearing on 3069 at the request of the sponsor of the bill, and that will be rescheduled at some later date. I also need to announce that my co-chair is next door testifying on his bill, and I expect to be called out to testify a bill downstairs in a few minutes, so we'll have a kind of catch and go.
I'll be here.
You'll be here?
Yeah,
well, we have plenty of able-membered bodies of the committee to hang out.
I'll be here for a while.
I was hoping we might have a co-vice chair to back us.
We may just have to have some impromptu stuff here, Mr. Chairman.
And maybe we're going to move some stuff today as well. We'll see.
I think we need a couple more voters.
Yeah, we can't move until we get a quorum, but we can have the public hearing before a quorum, so I'm going to open
up. We can do some virtual votes.
A public hearing on 2099. We have some of our members off their meds today or something.
I don't know. Something's up.
And I would like to call Kathy Kaufman, please, to testify in this bill. If there's anybody else interested in testifying, we stole the sign-up sheet, so let us know.
So which bill is it? Excuse me?
2099.
Okay.
You want to describe that bill, ma'am?
Sure. Mr. Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2099, comes to us at the request of the Oregon Health Authority. It requires that the Department of Revenue provides a place on the personal income tax return form for information about taxpayers' uninsured child and referral for health insurance coverage. It also requires that the Department of Revenue, the Oregon Health Authority, and the Department of Human Services to enter into a data sharing agreement for purposes relating to the requirements under the Federal Patient Protection and Affordable Act. This bill does have a subsequent referral to Revenue.
And do we have any revenue or fiscal impacts statements on this yet?
No, we don't, Mr.
Okay,
Chair.
Okay, great. Ms. Kaufman, go for it.
Co-Chair Greenlich, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kathy Kaufman. I'm the administrator of the Office of Healthy Kids in the Oregon Health Authority. The 2009 legislature expanded health coverage to all uninsured kids through the Healthy Kids program and also directed the agency to reach out and find all eligible children and get them enrolled as quickly and easily as possible. We've done just that. I'm happy to say that through last month, our latest data show that we've enrolled 78,000 of the 80,000 children we believe are out there and uninsured, and we've built up a great community-based outreach campaign that is working very effectively. One of the things that we'd like to do through House Bill 2099 is solidify our partnership with the Department of Revenue so that we can further our efforts to do outreach in as efficient a way as possible. By having tax filers let us know if they have an uninsured child in the household, we can reach out to them, and the Department of Revenue will direct them to our website and to our application. And by setting up a data sharing agreement between the Department of Revenue and the Oregon Health Authority, we can further our efforts to make the eligibility process more streamlined, not only for clients, but for us administratively, and reduce any possible fraud by checking the information that filers have with the Department of Revenue. So thank you. I'd be happy to answer any further questions that you have.
Has the Department of Revenue agreed to this? Or
the Department of Chair Greenlich, members of the committee, the Department of Revenue has been a tremendous partner. We've put this bill together with them, and in fact, I'm proud to say that, of their own volition, they put a blurb about healthy kids on the front of this year's state tax book. So they have been very willing partners, and we're very, very grateful for that.
Hey, Minister, do you have any idea why this is going to the Revenue Committee rather than Ways and Means from here? I mean, it's not about increasing or decreasing revenue. It's about an expense in their department to get
it. I don't know, Mr. Chair. I will inquire on that and see what the direction.
Do you know whether they have put a fiscal on this?
Co-Chair Greenlich, members of the committee, we have submitted this bill saying that there will be no fiscal impact, that we are able to cover whatever the cost of setting up the agreement through funds that we currently have.
But are they saying the same thing? Because they're the ones who print the revenue, the forms, right?
They are, but it won't be the printing of the form. It will be whatever their tech team needs to create the data sharing agreement, and we're going to fund that for them.
Okay. Are there other questions? Any questions? Oh, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Oh, wait a minute. Hold on. Oh, okay. Great. We have another person who would like to testify. John, will you join us? Where are you? There he is.
Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee, for the record, John Mullen with the Oregon Law Center. I'm happy to be here today to testify in favor of this bill. I'm currently on the Healthy Kids Advisory Committee, also on the Healthy Kids Steering Committee, and all along I've been impressed with the outreach work that has been done, the simplification of eligibility, and frankly the results, the enrollment results have been terrific. And in looking at this particular bill, this is yet another new and innovative way of reaching out to people. And the way in which the outreach, I think, has worked so well, from things like the billboards to the signs on buses and so forth, is part of normal everyday life for people to begin to see information about how they can get their kids enrolled. And I think this is just another opportunity to reach out to the public. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Madam Administrator, I wonder if you could, we need to check with Co-Chair Thompson, but I wonder if you could check in with the co-speakers and see, this doesn't, if it ends up with no fiscal impact and no revenue impact, I'm not sure. I think it was sort of mistakenly sent to Revenue Committee and see whether we can get that rescinded, or maybe at least substitute a Ways and Means if there isn't. Or maybe let's wait till there's going to be a fiscal to find out whether it needs to go to Ways and Means. But
right,
it doesn't seem, I don't think the Revenue Committee is going to want it to come to them.
Okay.
Right. Okay. I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2099 and open up. Do we have a quorum now?
Yeah. Barely.
Yeah. Okay. And open up a public hearing on House Bill 2174, and will you tell us what this is about, please? Do we have the sheet, the sign-up sheet?
It's coming up right now.
Good.
Mr. Co-Chair. Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2174 was introduced at the request of the Oregon Narcotics Enforcement Association, sponsored by Representative Cowan. It adds oxycodone, hydrocodone, methadone, and amphetamine to the controlled substances subject to substantial quantity and commercial drug offense provisions. It also adds endangering the welfare of a minor by allowing a minor to enter or remain in place where unlawful activity involving controlled substances is maintained or conducted to crimes for which a person may be placed on probation. This has an emergency clause. This, too, has a subsequent referral to judiciary.
Okay.
And I do believe, Mr. Chair, that I was able to get to you the Dash 2 amendments. The amendments were requested by the Narcotics Enforcement Association. We do have, and you also have a hand in gross bill of those amendments, of which I believe he's going to review for us. And Representative Cowan's here.
Representative Cowan, would you like to kick this off?
Certainly. Would
you like to join us when you're done, if you, or stay there, whatever you prefer?
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I just stepped out of another committee that I probably should return
to. Yeah, I'm going
to
be leaving for 1-2. So. Go for it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I am Jean Cowan, representative from House District 10, and here basically to just kick off your discussion or further discussion of House Bill 2174 and to introduce my tag team member, who I'm sure will be back very shortly, so I will talk
there
a little more shortly. With me today is Rob Bavette, District Attorney from Lincoln County, who asked me to bring this bill to your attention because of some shortcomings in the law that he feels are important, that we make sure that we close some loopholes and allow him to do his job. He is the expert on this particular subject, so I will turn it over to him, and thank you very much for your attention in hearing this bill today.
Thank you.
Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee, as Representative Cowan mentioned, my name is Rob Bovette. I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon Narcotics Enforcement Association, better known as ONEA. Unlike what you'd suspect from its title, ONEA has for the last 10 years authorized me to do legislation for them, and it's actually very seldom is it law enforcement legislation. I will tell you that, how shall I say this, business is too good. We have for many years in many legislative sessions brought you legislation which is designed to enhance science-based prevention and treatment. This bill was specifically intended to be a gut-and-stuff vehicle to address the growing issue of prescription drug abuse here in Oregon. On the back side of my testimony, you'll see just one quick chart. I didn't bring you a whole bunch of charts, but all the data tells us the same thing, which is that over the past 6 years, we've had a consistent uptick in prescription drug abuse. And the primary three prescription drugs that are abused, 1, 2, and 3, are hydrocodone, oxycodone, and methadone. This is a national trend, so we're not unique here in the state of Oregon. And so I offer this bill primarily as a vehicle to do some substantive policy improvements in the area of addressing prescription drug abuse. The Dash 2 amendments you have before you, I'll just run through very briefly. We initially intended this bill to be the vehicle for about 12 punch list items. But after further analysis, about 7 of those items would draw a fiscal. So we pulled all of those items. The 5 you have remaining, we believe, will not draw a fiscal. Frankly, it won't do a revenue or a fiscal for you. So let me just briefly describe what the Dash 2 amendments would do. And I have a kind of a cheat sheet that I put together for you as well, explaining these kind of punch by punch. The first thing the Dash 2 amendments do is they fill in the gaps in the blanks in the existing bill as it's printed. The bill as it's printed would move oxycodone, methadone, and hydrocodone into the commercial drug offense statutes. What that basically means is many legislative sessions ago, as a policy matter, we tried to find a way to separate the user dealers from the people that were really commercially dealing. We created a mechanism, we broke out the drugs, primary drugs of abuse, and we created a mechanism to essentially gauge that by the amount of drugs that people had for sale. And that actually, although it has some issues, it's actually been about the best device that any state has ever found, and our model is being adopted by other states. What we didn't do those few legislative sessions ago is deal with the three primary prescription drugs of abuse, oxycodone, hydrocodone, and methadone. So what this bill proposes to do is do exactly that, break these out and provide a mechanism to separate those that are really dealing large volumes of these drugs for drug dealing to make money as compared to the user dealers who we don't want to capture with this. So the first thing that this bill would do is fill in the blanks with the relevant substantial quantities that we're talking about, that being 100 pills and 75 pills. The second thing this does is, as the bill already does, it adds endangering the welfare of a minor to what we call our conditional discharge statute. The second thing the Dash 2 amendments would do is also add frequenting a place where controlled substances are used, which is a separate crime, to the conditional discharge statute. Let me tell you briefly what the conditional discharge statute is if you're not familiar with it. It's ORS 475-245, and it's basically a remedial statute. It takes certain drug offenders, puts them into the system, places them on probation without entering a conviction, allows them the opportunity to essentially earn a dismissal of the case by going, getting an assessment, getting treatment, essentially no longer becoming an addict, and then they earn dismissal of the case. We started the conditional discharge statute with possession of controlled substances. We still use that statute a lot for that purpose. In 2005, you allowed us, and ONEA brought you the bill, to expand that to property crimes driven by addiction. If you weren't already aware, the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission estimates that approximately 72% of all property crimes committed in Oregon are committed by addicts seeking to support their addiction. So the second thing the Dash 2 amendments would do would be to also add frequenting a place where controlled substances are used to the types of cases that qualify for conditional discharge. The third thing the bill would do would be to fix what we perceive and what the National Alliance for Model State Drug Laws perceives to be a technical glitch in our scheduling statute, 475-185. I'm happy to get into the intricacies of it if you want, but basically the way we drafted it, we glom Schedule 3, 4, and 5 all into the same subsection without clarifying which is prescription and which is non-prescription, and so we need to break the 3s and 4s out from the 5s to make it clear so nobody can misinterpret the statute. Nobody has misinterpreted the statutes, but this is really in the nature of a housekeeping bill to make things perfectly clear. The fourth thing that it does is it would repeal ORS 475-045. It's a statute that has, frankly, bothered me for many years, but I think it's time that we just get rid of this. This is a statute that prohibits the Oregon Board of Pharmacy from scheduling an FDA-approved OTC. The reason we want to repeal that statute is in the past, it has precluded our pharmacy board from being proactive in dealing with certain FDA OTCs that have gone bad. A perfect example is phenylpropanolamine from back in the late 90s and early 2000s. An FDA-approved OTC that, unfortunately, as we gathered data throughout the 90s, we learned that PPA was killing people, especially kids. The FDA eventually, after years of data, took action by issuing a notice of intent to reschedule that drug. And what happened was the industry voluntarily withdrew the drug from the market, ending the matter. But it's a perfect example because if our pharmacy board didn't have this statute, they could have acted much quicker than the federal government. So I believe this statute is just frankly bad public policy, and our pharmacy board needs to be fully empowered to do the job that we expect them to do. And then finally and lastly, the bulk of the Dash 2 amendments would create all of these new sections. Let me tell you, these new sections don't do anything substantively. All they do is they break out methadone, oxycodone, and hydrocodone into separate statutes, which is exactly what we did in 2005 in relation to other primary drugs of abuse, so we can track data, so we can know exactly how many folks are abusing which drugs. This is important to us for us to come back to you in future sessions with science-based, evidence-based policies. Right now, we just can't collect the data that we need. So we're asking to carve out these three primary prescription drugs of abuse as well. So with that, that's a real nutshell of what the Dash 2 amendments it would do to House Bill 2174. We urge you to move the Dash 2s into the bill and pass it on to the Judiciary Committee. Happy to answer any questions you might have. I have been keeping in close contact with Representative Krieger about this bill, and he doesn't have any objections to you working the substantive components here in this committee before you send it on to him.
Thank you. I always wanted to be on Judiciary Committee, and now is our chance. This is actually, to someone who has never served on Judiciary, this is quite an education, so yeah. Thank you. Are there questions? Representative Thompson.
You probably covered this, and I apologize for being in another committee for a while. Is it true that prescription drug abuse is still the fastest growing drug abuse segment?
And Mr. Co-Chair, if you actually look at the back side of my testimony, there's a nice little chart there, and it is true. In Oregon, it is the fastest growing segment of drug abuse in the state of Oregon, prescription drug abuse, by far, just by the accelerated numbers. But I will tell you, as I mentioned to the committee, this is a national trend. So, I mean, Oregon is unique in terms of the top line you see there with meth. No other state can show you that data. But every state, unfortunately and tragically, can show you that purple line that we're seeing here in Oregon.
Thank you. I apologize for not paying attention to your hand. Anything else? Okay. Okay. I guess we can close the public hearing on House Bill 2174.
Correct.
I'm trying get my bearings here. It doesn't work well to try to do two committees at the same time. And with that, we will open a public hearing on House Bill 2378. And would you care to inform us?
I will, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2378 came to us through the interim as a committee bill. It requires the non-transplant anatomical research recovery organizations to be licensed by the State Mortuary and Cemetery Board and to keep certain records. It also authorizes the board to impose civil penalties for any violation, exempts the Oregon Health and Sciences University and persons who obtain a waiver from the board from the application of the provisions of the bill. You also have a dash one amendment. That dash one amendment deleted on page 3, deleted the specificity of the Oregon Health and Sciences University and expanded it to all accredited institutions of higher education in this state that uses anatomical gifts for education and research. And that's all I have, Mr. Co-Chair.
Thank you. It appears we have three people prepared to testify today, so I'll call you up all at once and we'll do a panel. It will be Michelle Gaines, Mike Seeley, and Barbara Crow. And if you would kindly do what I did not do in the committee next door and identify yourself at the beginning. We'll start here.
Thank you for the record. My name is Michelle Gaines, and I'm the Executive Director for the Oregon Mortuary and Cemetery Board. And what I'm going to do is provide just an overview of some of the sections of the bill, and then the others here can speak more specifically to some of the aspects on the transplant side and some of the regulation federally. What this bill does is it would add regulatory oversight for a portion of the education and research procurement of anatomical material. And I'm going to try to use my words carefully here, but there are organizations, two that we're aware of in the state of Oregon, that do procure human remains and then, in essence, disarticulate those remains and distribute them to organizations that use them for educational research. This is different than the use of anatomical material for the purpose of transplant. And at this time, this specific use just for education or research is not directly regulated by any state agency. So what the bill does is it actually taps into an emerging national standard of accreditation for such organizations, which is where the long title comes from and why the bill references the requirement for that accreditation. I believe the reason why the Mortuary and Cemetery Board has been selected to be the regulator, if you will, for these types of organizations is that we already inspect the records and the facilities of funeral homes, cemeteries, crematories, and similar organizations that are facilities that are used for those kinds of purposes. There is a when I submitted a fiscal there, because there are only two entities that I'm aware of, there is no operational add to my organization that can be absorbed on the licensing side. What I did put into the fiscal was the potential that if there were a complaint that went all the way to the administrative hearing and a contested case, that is not in my budget. So you'll see in that fiscal just a placeholder. Truly, it's an unknown, but I wanted to have that up there because I would not have limitation to potentially cover that if that were to happen. The other thing that the bill does in section 3, which is on the second page, you'll see some language that have to do with tracking parts A and C, a record of the disposition, and 2 and 3. What we're really trying to do, there are a couple of things. One, we want to make sure that whereas the tracking system, if you will, for human remains was really designed based on the assumption that remains would stay whole and together, this process does disarticulate remains, and so we want to make sure that the different pieces of anatomical material are tracked and it is logged where they're distributed to. The reason for that is that we also want to preserve the transplant stream of material, and we want to make sure that this material, which is not screened in the same way, doesn't eventually end up into the transplant stream. You'll also see a bit here that asks about that speaks to disclosure to the family members. Part of what's happening now is that a family or an individual might donate their body to one of these organizations, and in some cases there's a free cremation that comes with it, and cremated remains are returned to the family members. Because of the nature of anatomical recovery, any residual portion can be treated as medical waste, which has a different set of criteria for cremation and handling and processing. What we just want to make sure in this is that if there is a family that is expecting to have the cremated remains of the remainder of their loved one, that it is made clear to them that it is just a portion, and that the facility is required to treat those remains, no matter how small, as human remains, and not commingle them during the cremation process. And that's simply to also ensure that families get back their relative and nothing else. So that's sort of the factual overview of the bill, and I can speak to any other questions on the board or the oversight, but otherwise I would turn it over to my fellows here at the table.
Can you give an example of what a non-transplant anatomical research recovery organization would be? Is this like a burn center or something? What are they?
Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Daugherty, it is specifically an organization that would acquire human remains that have been donated specifically for the purpose of education or research. And they're not connected with a hospital or a tissue bank or any other type of entity. And basically what they do is they will disarticulate those remains into portions that can be used by the entities that are doing the research or the education. And then they facilitate a transportation of those that specific part that's desired. So in essence, they're a disarticulation and transport type of company.
Got it. Thank you.
I'm going to ask a very specific question, and I don't be to be too graphic, but to get at exactly what's going on here, and I think maybe I understand it. If I were offering a podiatry course at a convention at Sun River, I have nothing against podiatrists, but as an example, could I order 40 human feet to be delivered to that meeting for teaching purposes?
Mr. Co-Chair, yes. And this is the type of organization that's in the business of procuring those feet.
Would they be connected back to donors in that, for lack of a better word, I could return them?
Our understanding is that no. I know that the families are not given knowledge of where the individual pieces go. Part of what this bill would do is require this recovery organization to keep records of where it was sent to. What it doesn't do is require those parts to be returned and the body, if you will, made whole, which is where it does differ from whole body donation, where, in fact, for example, at OHSU, they do, even if it's over a three-year process of use, maintain inventory of where everything is being used, bring all of that back together, cremate the remains, and return all of it to the family.
Okay. At the end of such a class, what are my options for disposing of those 40 feet legally right now?
They are considered medical waste.
Okay. And that means I can do what?
My understanding, and I'm not in the medical profession directly, but my understanding is that typically they will be bagged in biohazard, and they will be taken to an incinerator, either at the local hospital or at a crematory that handles such things. One distinction between human remains and human remains that in such case those parts that are considered medical waste you can commingle. So in essence, in your example, all 40 feet in one bag and cremated together, as opposed to human remains, which you cannot commingle.
Okay. Thank you. Other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Co-Chairman Thompson and members of the committee, my name is Barbara Crow, and I am the executive director of the Lions Eye Bank of Oregon. I appreciate the opportunity to come before you to testify in support of House Bill 2378, requiring the non-transplant research organizations to be licensed by the State Mortuary and Cemetery Board. Today I'm here on behalf of my organization and my colleagues at the Community Tissue Services, Pacific Northwest Transplant Bank, the American Red Cross Blood Services, and Donate Life Northwest. We feel the public benefits from specific state and federal oversight of our organizations as we provide life-enhancing cornea and tissue transplants and life-saving organs for transplant. Every aspect of our operations is regulated by government standards, from infectious disease testing, records of anatomical donations, allocation, distribution and shipping, disposition, and specific lifetime transplant recipient follow-up. Paramount to these important rules of oversight is public safety and organizational accountability. This regulatory framework allows for the public, potential donors, donor families, and recipients of transplants to be well-informed. Non-transplant anatomical research recovery organizations and their operations are not licensed or regulated by the state or the federal government. As a result of this lack of oversight, the public is not afforded any third-party system of checks and balances that ensures its safety. Rules as put forth in House Bill 2378 provide this opportunity. Medical science and the public do greatly benefit from the research provided by whole body donation. The measure of public protection provided by House Bill 2378 is a major step towards establishing uniformity in the rules governing human tissue donation and will better honor the public's intention in making such gifts. I thank you for the opportunity to testify in favor, and I would like you to know that representatives from each of the transplant and the regulated donation agencies are present and would be happy to assist or answer any questions that you may have. Thank you.
Questions? You did a wonderful job.
Thank you.
And Mike Seeley?
Co-Chair Thompson, members of the committee, I'm here actually to in support of Barbara, our organization. I'm the executive director of the Pacific Northwest Transplant Bank. Have followed along for many years this issue and am in favor of any initiative to provide some oversight.
Can I get you to state your name for the record, please?
Michael Steele.
I do that all the time, so I understand.
We've followed along for many years to support efforts to have oversight in this area. There's confusion to the public. Public safety is important. There is a big difference between the transplant community and how we're regulated. Every aspect of what we do is tracked for life so that we can be accountable and that the public's protected. This simply puts that measure in place for these organizations that do serve a public good in research. And we have medical science advances as a result, but the need for oversight, I think, is paramount, and the time has come for it. The only states that have done this successfully is New Jersey and Maryland, and I think that moving forward in this particular way, particularly with the mortuary board, is the right place to place this emphasis and to work to a better future in that regard. So I appreciate the opportunity to be a part, and certainly
Thank
would
you.
Welcome any questions.
Are there any questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess my question is, what's the impact of these organizations on donor, you know, legitimate donor banks like yours?
Co-Chair Thompson, Representative Kenmore, the impact is that, and this is a historical perspective of what's happened over many years, when an untoward event happens, if there's some publicity, if there's a misdirected event, there's some scandal, which there have been historically. If you follow this, there's a deep history of this that goes back, well, 100 years. The impact immediately is on our organizations because it is in the realm of donation. People have the option in certain circumstances to donate their whole body to academic centers and to these organizations. But the first call that will come when there's an event, because there isn't oversight, will be people are disenchanted about donation in general, which in our case then translates into people choosing not to donate, potentially, which involves the saving of lives, the enhancing of lives through tissue and eye and organ donation.
Yeah. Okay, Kenner. The second question is to stick with the chair's suggestion of a possible scenario. So let's suppose that someone has human feet and they dispose of them improperly. Perhaps they put them in a garbage sack and throw them in the dumpster just to be crass. How does this bill deal with that? Or does it?
Yeah.
Now, the organization that's registered is registered. They have a record of who took these. Now, what's the liability for the administration of these plants?
Co-Chair Thompson, Representative Kenmore, if there were such a case, there would first be an effort to determine where they originated. When this has happened in other states, they will check the hospitals and some of the other organizations. I guess that if we were to track it down to these organizations without the bill, there is no regulatory way to sanction these organizations if that was the point of origin. With the bill, it would give us the opportunity where they would require a license and they could be sanctioned either by having the revocation of license or a financial penalty.
And what would happen currently without the law?
Representative Kenmore and co-chairman and members of the committee, in an unregulated environment, nothing happens because there are no records kept and you can't look. At the iBank, we also do provide tissue for research. We also operate the donor referral center, so calls for all donation comes to the iBank with the exception of the few donors that are viable for organ donation. So we speak with the public, with 95% of the families who die in Oregon. To answer one question, if we have piece of the eye. For instance, if we transplant the cornea and the remaining portion of the eye goes to research, on our records, we know exactly where that went. And so we are subject to drop-in inspection by the Food and Drug Administration and inspection for accreditation. We must present all of these records to show that we do keep them and can track them so that as testing methods get better, down the line, if 2 years go by, if 3 years go by, and something new comes to light or some information comes to light, we can go back to our records, pull those records, and be able to notify the recipients, whether it be researchers or whether it be transplant, exactly where this went. If you are unregulated, you are not required to keep any records. You're not required to allow anyone to look at records. You're not required to disclose where this went. You're not required to have special precautions in shipping and handling. So we feel that for the safety of the public, it is best interest to be at least registered with the state and have some sort of regulation so that when the families call back to us in the call center thinking all donation comes through the iBank, we find that they're terribly confused and we have to explain quite a bit. An iDonor can still be a research donor, a research body donor, so as far as the impact, it's not a matter of impacting our program, it's just a matter of providing that extra measure of safety and accountability for the public.
Mr. Chair, another response, please.
Chair Thompson, Representative Kenemer. In light of your earlier question and this question, what happens? I think connecting the two, the outcome is that there will be an untoward public scandal, an event, and that has a direct impact on those people we're trying to serve and whose lives we're trying to save, and that means fewer donations for transplantation, which means people suffer. So that would be the likely scenario of someone coming across that in an open field. So I think that's a great question and one that is important and central to this issue. Thank you.
Representative Parrish, did you?
I did have a couple questions. And I'm going to try and frame them into one. So how many organizations do you feel like are operating in Oregon that are not licensed, and what is kind of the proposed fee that you're looking at? But also kind of more importantly, is this, you said this kind of as a hypothetical, we haven't had kind of an instance of wrongdoing, or do you, are you getting calls when someone has donated a body like this, and then they say, "I didn't get all the parts back"?
We do get calls. They're not a huge number, but we get calls from people who are confused as to where the body went, or they will. I actually got a letter from someone who was a Lion, who's well familiar with our organization, and was very surprised that he did not get all the cremated remains. He was under the impression that that was what would happen, that the remains would be returned to them after the research was accomplished. And then when they went to put it into an urn and realized it was so few, such small amount, he was very confused and phoned to talk with me about it. But this is just one. Normally these calls go through the donor referral line, and I don't always talk to them. This one happened to be someone I knew.
Can I just follow real quick to what you said? So the call that you described that you took, was that from a regulated donation, and this is a non-regulated type donation?
The gentleman who phoned me had donated the remains of his daughter to the unregulated.
Right. Thank you.
Because they're not a wealthy family, and this provided, as they were told, free cremation.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And then I think you can answer the fee.
Co-Chair Thompson and Representative Parrish, our licensing fees are based on the cost of operations. So we would price the licensing fee, if you will, based on the equivalent of what we charge for a funeral establishment. This language is a little bit different. We're on a biennial cycle. This would be an annual, so we would make it the equivalent of the 1 year, but it wouldn't be any more or any less. And I apologize because off the top of my head, I can't recall the cost on a funeral establishment. $350 annually. Support from my call home. And there are two agencies that we are aware of that operate within the state of Oregon.
Thank you.
Yep. Thank you. May I make another comment?
Please.
One other aspect that I think ties into some of this is the bill also has a requirement for these organizations to have nonprofit status, and would also require that if there is a larger organization that has a for-profit branch, because some of these organizations are not only now just procuring, but they are building facilities for education, so that they're both, if you will, the procurement side and then the organization that is then selling the classes and benefiting, if you will, from the supply. And what the stance that this bill takes is that be in light of the Anatomical Gift Act, and that you cannot sell human tissue of any sort, that they should be nonprofit. And if their larger organization does have a for-profit branch, it needs to be completely organizationally and financially separate.
Representative Cannon? Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am, first of all, so very grateful to see this bill coming forward. As Mr. Seeley knows, we worked on this issue back in 2007 after I heard from a constituent about personal experience related to one of these companies, and it was pretty horrifying. We, at the time, passed out of the House, with Representative Greenlick's help, a bill to establish a task force that would have studied this. It went over to the Senate, had full support, but it did not have funding, and it died in Ways and Means. So I'm grateful to see this bill coming forward. Nevertheless, obviously, you all have been off working on it in the meantime, and we have a good piece of legislation in front of us. I do have a couple of questions about it. Number one, would employees of the organization who are doing this work be required to be licensed as well, or is this just a licensing requirement for the company? Help me understand.
Sure. Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Cannon, the license requirement would be a facility license. There are some requirements in the accreditation that would require a medical doctor, for example, to be a director of the facility. And the details of the accreditation requirement has a training or certain certification, if you will, for the employees. And that would need to be maintained in order, that accreditation would need to be maintained in order for them to be licensed.
Okay. So what types of either disclosure requirements or regulations does this bill anticipate related to the business operations of the organizations, the entities? So would the board have the power, the licensing board, to make known to the public who was transacting with the organization, and to what extent would we be pulling back the mask from this industry, which I would say is shrouded, at least from my experience of this, is pretty shrouded in secrecy about where these parts are ending up.
Mm-hmm. Do you want to? No, it would be the...
Well, co-chair, Greenlick co-chair Thompson, co-vice chair Cannon, I think what this bill accomplishes, and could be part of an evolution of thinking as this evolves over time, is in a realm of accountability that these organizations keep records of where these gifts came from, where they end up, and the further step likely should be, and I think this is true in New Jersey, that the accountability for the final disposition of what was used by a third party. These groups sell to third parties, anatomical demonstration groups, orthopedic organizations all over the country. They've gravitated here to Oregon because there is no oversight. I don't know that that's a public disclosure, because it is a private matter of donating. In our realm, we don't disclose that, but to our regulators. So the regulator comes in, the United Network for Organ Sharing, in our case with organ donation and transplantation, all of those records are kept. And we have actually an exception to HIPAA so that we can accomplish our mission and our task, but that's private information that likely shouldn't be disclosed. But having a regulatory entity have access to assess if that's being done properly, I think is the proper way to go about this, if that answers your question.
That's very helpful.
The only piece that I would add to that is this was crafted with the accreditation requirement being first and foremost, because smarter heads than mine certainly are looking at this issue, and as it emerges, the statute would keep that as current as possible. Our state regulation would be a secondary review to make sure that, yes, they are accredited. We can check that out. We would have access to the records to make sure everything is in order. If there were a complaint and we did an investigation, that is confidential during the process. If there were a finding in a final order, we would protect the complainants or any kind of protected medical information, but we would disclose to the public that there was a complaint or a discipline that was taken against the organization. And that would be public record.
Thank you. And just a final question. Have the companies weighed in on this proposed legislation? I don't think anyone signed up to testify.
Nobody has signed up to testify. I would ask, is there anybody here to testify in opposition?
Or support?
Or support, yeah. Well, I assume the support is decided. Anybody else? Okay. The answer is I think we have what we have.
Yep. Great. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Other questions? Great. Well, thank you very much. If there's nobody else to testify, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2378. Turns out we don't have either a fiscal or a revenue statement on one or the other of the bills that we could have a public hearing on. I mean, a work session on. So we will hold these until we get those statements and then find out whether we have enough votes to have
a
work session or not. And in the meantime, I will note for the record, 10 minutes to 4, we are adjourned.
This is an all-time record.